Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
My name is Adam Ruttenberg at Beacon Law Group. I am the co-chair of the Strategic Thought Leadership Committee of the Bankruptcy Section of the BBA. Our committee is designed to look at big picture things in the practice of bankruptcy law, and student loans are one of the biggest. A couple of years ago, I was absolutely shocked to learn that there is more student loan debt in the United States than there is credit card debt. And the development is that the Biden administration has issued a guidance, which is probably the first thing that's happened in bankruptcy law in 25 years that makes things easier to discharge in bankruptcy rather than harder. Our panel today is going to be moderated by Grace Brockmeyer. Grace is a staff attorney at the Volunteer Lawyers Project, as well as the co-chair of the consumer section. The Consumer Committee of the Bankruptcy Section. A quick word about the VLP, Volunteer Lawyers Project, matches cases of people who can't afford lawyers with volunteer lawyers to represent them. I've represented a number of VLP clients in pro bono Chapter 7s. And what I always say is that pro bono clients are the only ones who will send you written thank you notes. And with that, I'd like to have Grace get us started.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for the warm introduction and for the shout out to VLP. Very much appreciate it. Today, we are thrilled to have the following panelists speak with us about this topic. We have Stephanie Pelton, who is an attorney at Madoff & Curry, LLP, and her primary focus is on counseling clients regarding personal and corporate insolvency matters. We also have Brendan Mochler and Raquel Kay, who are assistant United States attorneys in the Asset Recovery Unit. Part of their practice involves bankruptcy litigation on behalf of the United States. Noel, if you could lead us into the second slide, that would be great. Thank you. So this program consists of four topics or four areas. The first is an introduction that provides the background and objectives of the guidance. Secondly, panelists will discuss fundamentals which deal with components of the guidance. Then we will address implementation and how to use the guidance and attestation. Finally, we will conclude with questions and answers. And I encourage the audience that if you have questions during the program to please put them in the Q&A, and they will be addressed to the best of our ability at the end of the program. I will now turn the training over to the Assistant United States Attorney, Raquel Kay, to begin our part two discussion on the new student loan discharge guidance.
Thank you, Grace. So I'm going to keep this part very brief because most of this session is going to be focused on the practical application of the guidance and how to fill out the attestation form. As many of you probably know, the new guidance issued to Department of Justice attorneys is designed to apply in student loan adversary proceedings brought in bankruptcy cases. There is a heightened standard for the discharge of student loans under the bankruptcy code. And you'll find that in section 11 USC 523A8. It's the undue hardship standard, and it says that student loans cannot be discharged unless the loans they cannot be discharged unless the loans would impose an undue hardship on the debtor and the debtor's dependents. Courts have developed two tests in analyzing whether undue hardship is present. The first test is the most common test applied nationally, and that's the Brunner test. That test is a three-part test looking at the past, present, and future financial circumstances of the debtor. The other test that's been developed is the totality of the circumstances test. That's a multi-part test that has a variety of elements and factual showings that are pretty similar to the Brunner test. The First Circuit has not adopted either test to date. Many bankruptcy courts in Massachusetts have found that the tests are fairly similar, although most judges here have been applying the totality of the circumstances test. The guidance is designed to encompass the factors under both tests. So what are the objectives of the guidance? I mean, the idea is to set clear, transparent, and consistent expectations for debtors so that everyone can understand what the rules are and how the guidance will be applied. And the second objective is to reduce burdens by simplifying the fact-gathering process through a form attestation that's required by the guidance, and that Stephanie is going to give you some great practice tips for completing in the second half of the presentation. And then finally, to identify proceedings where the government can stipulate to undue hardship.
And I just wanted to say the second one, reducing the burden, I think that this is a very important one, especially since many of these cases involve plaintiff debtors who are pro se. The government came up, Department of Justice and Department of Education came up with this guidance in a real effort to make things easier and significantly reduce the burden on debtors, but also debtors' counsel to really get these cases moving and to, in some ways, market the discharging of student loans. So I just wanted to emphasize that second point for everyone. So we're going on to this slide. This is kind of the general purpose of the guidance, a little bit about where it came from, some of the history, and what it's really looking to accomplish. Here, the guidance is actually a guidance to Department of Justice attorneys, Raquel and me. It's pretty much guidance to us on how we should handle these things and what we should look at and how we should review them. But the guidance is publicly available. It's on Department of Education's website. It's also on DOJ's website. You can just Google it and find it, immediately find it. It's really helpful for everyone, not just for Raquel and me, to read it, because it increases the transparency of what we're looking for, what Department of Education is looking for, and how to get there as quickly and easily as possible. So there's really two components. It's recommendations to the AUSAs and in some cases Department of Education attorneys for really how to assess these kinds of cases, as well as the procedure for completing and submitting the attestation form. We'll be going over a lot of that later on in the presentation. And like I said before, this is really about reducing the burden, making things easy for debtors and debtors' counsel to get these cases reviewed in the best way and best outcome possible. We go to the next slide, please. So I'm sure for debtors' counsel who's watching this, you know about the debtor's present financial circumstances, future, and kind of a future going ability to pay, inability to pay, financial prospects, that kind of thing, as well as the good faith analysis. This is all kind of bundled up together in this three-factor analysis. Can the debtor make these loan payments while maintaining a minimal standard of living? This is really key. No one's looking to have a debtor make student loan payments at the expense of a minimum standard of living. We're all looking to ensure that the debtor has a minimum standard of living that's reasonable, and the guidance set forth and that we're discussing on this presentation today really does a good job of making sure that we're keeping that in mind. We're also looking at, will that current inability to pay, will that continue into the future? At times, bankruptcy relief solves a lot of these problems for debtors, and they're able to bounce back and they have an ability to pay in the future for their student loans. Other times, this inability to pay in the present circumstances will continue to exist in the future. That's what we're looking for. Will this current inability to pay, will it continue indefinitely or at least several years out? And the last part is, has the debtor demonstrated good faith efforts to repay the student loans? This mostly looks back on the history going back a few years on debtors' attempts to repay, what the circumstances was, what's the payment history, what's the communication with the servicer. And we'll go over all of this in more detail. But again, everybody, I guess, is familiar with this three-factor analysis. The guidance doesn't change it. It just captures it more in a succinct fashion.
Okay, so jumping right into factor one, this is looking at, as Brendan mentioned, the debtor's present circumstances and whether they can make loan payments while maintaining that minimal standard of living. So how does the guidance do that? one of the main ways the guidance assesses the debtor's expenses, which is the first thing that it looks at under this factor, is using the IRS standards to assess minimal standard of living. And so for anyone that doesn't know, the IRS standards set monthly expense amounts for necessary expenses in various categories and divided by family size. How can you find these IRS standards? There's two ways. One is a very simple Google search. If you Google IRS standards, national standards, local standards, it should pop right up. It will give you more information about how the standards are calculated if you're curious, and more information about what is designed to be included in each category. The other way is to have the most current attestation form, which I think, again, Stephanie will talk about with you later, and is generally going to be provided to you at the beginning of an adversary proceeding by our office. And so the guidance uses the national standards for categories including food, housekeeping, supplies, apparel, personal care products and services, and miscellaneous expenses. Everything is combined into the national standard category other than uninsured medical costs, which has its own separate national standard, but is also national as opposed to the local standards. And so the guidance uses the local standards for other categories like housing and transportation. As I mentioned, you can find both of these easily by Googling, and the attestation form actually lists the dollar amounts for these categories on the form itself, so you don't have to go searching for them. And then the guidance in looking at expenses is also going to look at other necessary expenses like taxes, health and life insurance, daycare, and other expenses. And so we're going to stay on the expense train for a while, but just not to hide the ball, we're eventually, as you might expect, going to be comparing expenses to income in order to assess, you know, present circumstances. So something that's, I think, very helpful to think about when you're looking at the national standards and filling out these forms for your client is that the debtor can claim the national expense amount even if their actual expenses are lower. So if you have a debtor and they're a single person living by themselves and their food expenses for the month are generally $350, they can still claim the full $466 expense under the guidance. Similarly, they can claim the combined total national standard expense amount, which includes all those categories I mentioned other than uninsured medical costs, even if their actual expenses are lower. So if you have a debtor that's part of a family of two and they generally spend only $1,250 per month on these categories, they could claim the full $1,389 under the current standards. And the same goes for standard uninsured medical expense amount. If their out-of-pocket medical costs are lower than that standard amount, they can still claim the full standard amount for each household member.
So for these national standards, mm-hmm. Everyone should be including at least what these standards set forth. You know, there's no need to dip below for the national standards. And it's important just to remember national versus local. Raquel's talking right now about national.
Yeah, that's right. And so actually, to Brendan's point, well, I'll get to Brendan's point in 1 second. So you might be saying to yourself, what happens though if my debtor has amounts that are in excess of the national standard? The guidance does allow debtors to request that DOE consider allowing amounts that are in excess of the national standard. You only need to do this if your client's expenses go over the combined amount. So if the total amount is less than the national standard combined amount or at the national standard combined amount, you don't need to provide further explanation. So for example, if they're spending a little bit more on food, but a little less on housekeeping, but the total is less than the national standard, claim the national standard. If their total is more than the national standard, then you should figure out which category they're going over in and then provide an explanation as to why that category is over the standard amount. Same goes for out-of-pocket medical expenses. They can explain their reason for exceeding the national amount. And what the guidance is going to look at there is whether these additional expenses are necessary for the debtor's minimal standard of living. And it's very helpful to DOE's review of these additional amounts if you can provide supporting documentation.
So we're we're continuing along discussing present circumstances. This is what's going on in the debtor's life at the time the adversary proceeding is commenced. The IRS local standards, remember I said that there's national standards, that was what Raquel was just discussing, and then local standards. The local standards are different than the national standards in that these are the caps. The debtor can claim the lesser of actual or the standard amounts. So the debtor should be listing the actual expenses in these categories. There's no kind of benefit of the doubt, include the national standard amount. It doesn't work that way with the local standards. Local standards are housing expenses and transportation expenses. And you can imagine why these are local standards, because these are the two expenses that greatly differ across the country, depending on where debtors are living. So rent and mortgage payments, vastly different. They're going to be using the local standards to kind of fine tune it to the geography that the debtor's home is. Taxes and insurance, maintenance costs, utilities, all of this is wrapped up in the housing expenses. Transportation expenses, it's broader than just a bus ticket or a train ticket, but includes ownership costs for your vehicle, the operating cost, and as well as public transportation. You can use all of these things. And if you have multiple vehicles, the standards apply to each vehicle. It's not a combined total. Just like with the national standards, where the debtors are allowed to claim a greater amount than what the local standards provide. We just need an explanation that makes sense, that's complete, that we can look at and understand, yes, this makes sense. This is why it's a higher amount. So excessive amounts, but amounts higher than the local standards are allowed. We just need to make sure we have documentation that shows why this is necessary and reasonable.
Yeah, again, it's always going back to that minimal standard of living.
So there's also other necessary expenses. These are ones that were not included in the first two categories that we've discussed. There's no formal caps. This is somewhat a catch-all that for categories of expenses that don't fit into the first two categories. But since it's somewhat of a catch-all, we also need extra information on this, of why these expenses are not only necessary, but reasonable. Most require some form of explanation on the attestation form. Again, you'll see that later on in the presentation about where you can include that. But they have to be necessary, reasonable, and most need to have some pretty solid explanation as to what they are. They also include payroll deductions. These are other necessary expenses under the IRS standards as well. And you can see on the left of this slide, by the way, here are some examples of other necessary expenses that may or may not apply to a debtor situation.
Yeah, and it's going to be those that probably require the additional explanation as opposed to, for example, the payroll deductions. Like those should be generally self-explanatory.
So there's also this idea of anticipated future expenses. This is somewhat difficult to assess, at least for me, it's difficult to assess. But these are expenses that have to be incurred but are not incurred at least yet. These are kind of expenses to make sure that a debtor can maintain the minimum standard of living. And the example that we have here is substandard housing, that the debtor right now is in an apartment that's not suitable. It's low rent, it's a studio, but the debtor has three kids and they're in a studio. So it's just not appropriate for the debtor and the three children to be in that apartment. We want to make sure that that debtor is able to move into another apartment that'll be more expensive, but it's an anticipated expense. They haven't moved yet. That's something that we'll be looking at and that we hope debtors have enough information to know about this anticipated future expense category that they can include these type of things. And that's just one example. It's kind of for these situations where debtors in the middle of changing locations, changing circumstances, but they haven't yet done it. So expenses the debtor's not currently incurring, but will soon, and they're necessary and reasonable for them to start incurring these expenses. The guidance allows these expenses as long as, if you look at 1 and 2, they're consistent, of course, with the IRS national and local standards, or in those events or in those situations where a debtor has provided explanations of why their expenses exceed those allowable amounts, those expenses are also allowed under the guidance. And the attestation allows the debtor to list these anticipated future expenses. I just think this is really helpful for debtors to look into and to really consider whether they have any future expenses that fall into this category, especially with bankruptcy. The debtor's life is changing. They could be moving. They could have found a new job. There could be extra expenses that will be incurred in the future but haven't yet. So I really urge debtors and debtors' counsel to consider this category very carefully.
Yeah, and some other examples there, maybe, you know, for example, if the debtor right now is sleeping on someone's couch, well, you know, but needs to have housing, or the debtor is using public transportation, but because of a new medical condition may not be able to continue to do so and would need a car to be able to get themselves places in the future.
Or a new job that requires them to wear some type of clothing that they don't already have. You know, those are all the kind of examples. So it's really important to think about expenses, not only that you have now, but that you will probably have in the future.
Okay, so now how do we make the determination? As I mentioned earlier, after the debtor's allowed expenses are calculated, they're compared to the debtor's gross income. Like expenses, you should include the entire household's gross income, and the income has to be verified. The attestation form in question 12 goes through the various ways that you can verify income. The default is to provide recent tax returns, but if those are not reflective of the debtor's current income, you can also look at the 2 months of gross income that have, you know, the most recent 2 months of gross income, and you can provide pay stubs to verify those amounts or use other documentation that you think will reflect whatever their current income is in those circumstances at the time the form is filled out. Then once that income is compared to expenses, there's going to be 3 possible outcomes. So the first, if their income does not exceed expenses, then the debtor satisfies factor 1. So if the debtor is earning $800 per month but has $1,000 worth of expenses, factor 1 is met. On the other hand, if the income is greater than their allowed expenses by enough that the debtor could make a regular standard student loan payment, then the debtor is going to fail factor 1. And then the third option is if the debtor's income exceeds the expenses by less than the standard monthly payment amount, they'll satisfy factor 1, but only a partial discharge might be appropriate. And that's something I think Brendan is actually going to discuss a little bit later in the presentation. The partial discharge.
That's right. So assessing future circumstances, I think, is more difficult than assessing present circumstances, because with present circumstances, you just look what's going on in your life right now. Future circumstances, you have to see what your future holds, and it kind of involves this fortune teller approach. But the guidance has presumptions that an inability to repay will continue to persist. There's 5 presumptions that we have listed here. They are rebuttable presumptions. So you see the first one, the debtor 65 or older. That's a presumption. For a more elderly debtor, there's a presumption that the inability to pay that's already been established under factor 1 will continue in the future. But it's rebuttable. If that 65-year-old debtor has a lucrative job offer where they're going to be making $500,000, then that's a presumption that's going to be rebutted by the fact that they have this lucrative job offer, just as an example. The other presumptions are disability or injury impacting income, significant unemployment 5 years out of the last 10 years, never obtaining the degree that was pursued and for which the student loan debt was incurred, and a debtor's loan has been in repayment status for 10 years. All of these are rebuttable based on concrete evidence that the debtor would have the future ability to pay. But if you're a debtor and you fall into one of these categories, or if your debtor's counsel and your clients fall into one of these categories, that's good. That's good. Good news for you. It's a presumption that the current situation will continue to persist and helps you along the road to establish this second factor of future circumstances.
One thing I did want to just quickly note about the repayment status, the loan being in repayment status for 10 years, is that sometimes folks forget that often you have a 6-month grace period, for example, after graduation. So that's not calculated from graduation. It's calculated from when the loans went into repayment. And also that under the guidance, in-school deferments don't count towards those that 10 years. And I think, as you can see right here on the slide, those aren't the only presumptions. So if you don't, if your debtor doesn't fall under the 10 years, that doesn't mean that there's no way they would ever, you know, satisfy this factor under the guidance. But, you know, you'd have to be showing other circumstances that establish that their situation is going to persist. Okay. Factor three. Now we're going to look back in time at past circumstances and whether the debtors demonstrated a good faith effort to repay the student loan debt. The good faith test, it's fact sensitive and multifaceted. There's not going to be any single factor that's dispositive. And we're going to talk about a few examples under the guidance. But generally what the guidance is trying to do is assess the debtor's behavior relating to the student loan debt. And then it's also looking to assess the debtor's efforts to obtain employment, maximize their income, and minimize their expenses. So some examples of what's treated as good faith evidence: meaningful engagement with the services or others, phone calls, trying to figure out a solution, you know, for repayment, inquiring about their loan, past payments, applications for deferment or forbearance, and consideration of or enrollment in an income-driven repayment program.
And I think it's really important to highlight that good faith efforts to repay a student loan debt doesn't mean actual payments have to have been made, just that the debtor might have made several calls to the servicer. They might have responded to letters from the servicer or Department of Education. All of that shows good faith communication, exchange between the debtor and the servicer or Department of Education. So if you have a client, for those debtors' counsel out there who has a client where there's been no payments made, it doesn't mean that your client's going to fail the good faith effort test. Look at what else has been done in terms of communication and exchange of information between the debtor and the servicer or Department of Education.
And then when they're looking at whether the debtors made efforts to obtain employment or maximize their income and minimize their expenses, they're going to look at whether the expenses fall within the IRS standards as one example. And then they'll also look at whether a debtor's particular personal or family obligations and circumstances either can reduce their employment opportunities or increase their expenses.
So here we're continuing along with good faith efforts to repay the student loan debt, going back in history and seeing what was done or what was not done. And I guess I actually jumped to Japan here. But this is what I just said, that the failure to make payments is not dispositive of good faith. It's perfectly fine for a debtor not to have made payments, as long as you can show there's some kind of exchange, that they didn't go into MIA status with the servicer, they've responded to requests, you know, answered any questions, responded to letters, inquiries, that type of thing. Part of assessing the past circumstances is looking at whether there was any income-driven repayment plan. Entering into these plans is evidence of good faith. Discussing these or thinking about them in some meaningful way is also evidence of good faith. Not enrolling it is not per se lack of good faith, but enrolling it is an example of good faith. The guidance asks whether there's a reasonable explanation for non-enrollment. There's many different explanations why a debtor may not have enrolled in an IDRP. The first one is pretty loaded, actually. The first two are pretty loaded, that the debtor was discouraged from enrolling or denied access. I think we've all seen the different press reports and various lawsuits filed that were discussing inaccurate information provided to debtors concerning the IDRPs. If debtors relied on this kind of misinformation or misrepresentations, that certainly is a reasonable explanation. That might explain why they didn't enroll, why they were denied access, that they were given this inaccurate information. They might have also held a belief that's reasonable, that this wouldn't improve their circumstances. This is another reasonable explanation. or that they were simply unaware of these examples or worried about the tax consequences of entering into an IDRP.
Okay, so you may be wondering how assets that the debtor may have fit into the undue hardship picture under the guidance. And so under the guidance, recommending discharge may not be appropriate if the debtor retains significant assets that are not consistent with the minimal standard of living that the guidance is looking at. But the guidance will also consider whether these particular assets are actually necessary for the debtor to maintain that minimal standard of living. So it's having assets is not dispositive failure of the guidance's undue hardship test. The exempt status of property is also not going to be dispositive, but the DOE is going to liquidate primary residences and retirement accounts only in exceptional circumstances. Again, as Brendan mentioned at the beginning, we're looking for people to maintain that minimal standard of living. And dispositive weight is also not going to be given to the existence of assets that are not easily converted into cash.
So partial discharge is an option. This is relevant for those debtors that have some income left over after all of their expenses have been subtracted based on the national and local standards. But that income isn't enough to pay the entire amount of the monthly student loan debt. In those cases, a partial discharge is allowable when there's some ability to make payments. Again, somewhere between 0 and 100% of that monthly payment. It's possible if the debtor has significant assets or disposable income to pay that, and it should be tailored to leave only the balance that the debtor can pay over the remaining loan term. So whatever that monthly amount is that the debtor has, that they can otherwise save, they can pay that towards the student loan per month for the rest of the term of their student loans. So partial discharge is something that's really helpful for a debtor that has a little extra income left over, but that's not enough to pay those student loans.
Okay, we're getting to the good part. Part three, implementation and the attestation form. And we promise you're almost done with me and Brendan and going to get to hear from Stephanie. So the attestation, it's designed to make the guidance easier to apply. It can be used at any point in the litigation, but the debtor is strongly encouraged to complete it early. And I think Brendan's going to mention in a minute that we will send that form to you at the beginning of a case. It's good to keep in mind that the guidance applies to all Title IV student loan debt, including borrowers of undergraduate Parent PLUS loans. I also want to note that while the attestation is designed to make the guidance easier to apply, it doesn't limit the United States' ability to seek verification or supporting documentation, which is why we've mentioned at various points, and I think Stephanie will also cover this as well, places where it's helpful for you to provide that supporting documentation in advance. At the same time, it's designed to ideally avoid the need for costly fact-finding discovery. So don't feel the need to provide voluminous documentation, just, limited documentation that, you feel allows us to verify places where you've set forth facts that are a bit outside of, what the attestation is contemplating. And then just finally, the attestation should not be docketed. It's just for internal DOJ and DOE consideration.
So the process is debtors still have to file a complaint seeking discharge of the student loans. They still have to file that adversary or commence that adversary proceeding. That complaint and summons still needs to be properly and timely served on the Department of Education for all of this to kind of get the kickstart. Don't call Department of Education or call our office and say that you're looking to have things discharged. We need the complaint on file. We need it properly served and timely served. And once that happens, then Department of Education will refer the case to our office and they'll provide certain information to us, including the attestation form and information on the debtor's outstanding loan balance, other relevant information. We'll take that information and forward it to the debtor if pro se or debtor's counsel or plaintiff's counsel. and ask if you're interested in completing the attestation and going through this process. Most debtors, I believe, are interested in completing this because it's, I think it's easier and a lot less expensive than litigating it in bankruptcy court. But we, in order to provide time for this process, we would like to extend the deadline for us to otherwise respond to the complaint. So we have a template motion to stay deadlines while we work this out, while we send the attestation to you and you send it off to your client to complete and then send it back to us for us to review and Department of Education to review. So that's really how the process starts, with a timely and properly filed complaint. And then we'll reach out with the attestation form and other related information. And with that, I believe we're going through the attestation form right now.
We're turning over to Stephanie.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. So the attestation, it has these six parts you see here. And those are the things that they are going to consider, the AUSA is going to consider when they're performing their three-factor analysis, you know, present inability to pay, future inability to pay, good faith. I believe that the guidance was provided to you in the handouts today. If for whatever reason you didn't get it, it is publicly available online. My suggestion to you is that you get it and that you review it in connection both with filing your complaint and in completing the attestation, because it's very thorough. It is essentially the equivalent of the other team giving you their playbook prior to the big game. So make the most of it. As Brendan said, that this does not change the initial procedure for seeking a discharge. You still have to file the bankruptcy case, and then you still have to file the AP case. Rule 4007 says that a bankruptcy case may be reopened at any time for the purpose of seeking a determination regarding the dischargeability of debt, and that it can be reopened without the necessity of an additional filing fee for that purpose. Oh, could we have the next slide, please? So the attestation. One of the things that I'm going to point out is that, and you'll probably notice in your handouts, that this is not the most current version of the attestation. There is a newer version, and you'll see that when we get to the local and national standards. The ones that you see in this presentation have already changed. So just keep that in mind. But so section one here, we start out with personal information, you know, who is your debtor, their name, their address. If we could move on to the second one. Who is in their household? That's the, you know, the other sort of thing that you need to be aware of, because everybody who's in the household, their circumstances sort of get included too. You'll see here that the attestation has instructions sort of embedded within it and within footnotes. If you prefer, which is what I did, I deleted the instructions and the footnotes from my final version just because it was distracting to me to have them in there. It felt weird to have my client sort of signing something that had all of these instructions in it. And also, I wanted to include my own footnotes. But you'll see here on this second page where the AUSA says they are going to furnish you with the information that you need in order to complete this attestation. And they do provide you with quite a bit of information. One of the handouts that was provided is an example of what you're going to get. It's the one that says U.S. Department of Education cover sheet and loan records. And part of the information that they provide is how to use the information that they're providing. So you can see, it literally will say, here's the information that you need to use to answer attestation question 8, attestation question 12. It spells it out for you. Then they are also going to provide your student loan records. In my case, that was the NSLDS student loan information. That's going to provide you with a lot of other information you're going to need, the type of loans that your debtor has, you know, Perkins loan, whatever, whether it's federally serviced, whether it's been, you know, consolidated, whether it's in a income-driven repayment plan. If for some reason the AUSA does not provide you with that information, it can be obtained directly from the NSLDS website. The thing you need to be aware of there is, as debtor's counsel, you cannot log in to the borrower's NSLDS file for them. That is a crime. Big no-no. That doesn't mean that you can't sit there next to them while they're doing it, help walk them through the, you know, the process. You cannot log in for them. Can we have the next slide? So part 2 of the attestation is where we start getting into the income and expenses. The AUSA is going to review this section in connection with their first factor, which is their current inability to repay. As you'll see in the instructions here, it says if your Schedule I is less than 18 months old, you can refer to those figures. If it's more than 18 months old or circumstances have changed, then you need to provide updated circumstances. And you'll also see here where you are required to provide information for all members of the household. So these are things that you may not necessarily have included on your Schedule I or your means test. So if somebody has, you know, an elderly or disabled parent who maybe lives with them and gets Social Security or disability and they're not regularly contributing that to the household, that's not something that you would include on I or the means test, but you have to disclose it here. So, you know, just be aware of that you're going to have to be gathering information not only about your debtor, but about other members of your debtor's household. Can we go to the next slide, please? The other thing is, you know, even if you are relying on Schedule I, question 12 requires you to provide supporting documentation in any event. So that's, you know, tax returns, most recent tax return that your debtor and any member of their household has filed, or, you know, recent pay stubs if your debtor is employed, other verifying information. So you'll see in the sample attestation that's provided in the handouts, not the form, but the sample that's actually filled out, I included an index of exhibits at the end to show you sort of what kinds of things we're providing. And you can see there, it included things like, you know, the statement from the Social Security Administration, the statement regarding, you know, SNAP benefits, things like that. You'll also see in the example attestation where a Section 8 voucher was disclosed. That information went into a footnote because I felt like, well, you know, no, it's not really income because it's being paid directly from the housing authority to the landlord, it's still a benefit that the debtor is receiving. So, you know, I included that for 2 reasons. The first was just to be completely transparent. And the second was to sort of signal to the AUSA, look, here's somebody who has already been qualified for certain kinds of assistance programs, has already demonstrated that they have this need for assistance. And again, all sources of income have to be included, even stuff that would not be necessarily included on the means test. So for the means test, you don't have to include Social Security income, you know, as part of the disposable monthly income calculation. But for purposes of the attestation, you have to include all sources of income because all of them will be used to determine whether the debtor has any ability current inability to repay. Could we go to the next slide? So this is where we start to get into the debtor's expenses. These expense categories do not explicitly require supporting documentation, but to the extent that you have it, I would suggest that you provide it. Answer the question before it's asked. It's just going to go easier that way. In general, if you want this process to move as quickly as possible, then think about, when you're answering these questions, what the next logical follow-up question is going to be, and try and answer it before it even gets asked. So the expense category starts with the national standards. As we mentioned before, those are your floor. So you get the full amount of that expense, even if your debtor's actual expenses are lower than that. And as I just said a few minutes ago, these numbers that you see here are already stale. Those are not the numbers. So I would suggest that, if there's been some time between when the AUSA sent you the form attestation and said, here's the current form of the attestation that we want you to fill out, sometimes there's going to be a lag, weeks, even a couple of months between when they provide that form to you and when you submit it. So you're going to want to make sure that you double check those standards and that you are using the correct numbers at the time that you actually submit your attestation. If we could go on to the next slide, please. So if your expenses exceed the national standards, you do have the opportunity here to provide an explanation for, why it's necessary for them to spend more than that amount. And you'll see in the example, that I provided, we gave an explanation for that. With respect to food expenses and also uninsured medical expenses. let's see, we can go to the next slide. We're running out of time. Okay, so next here, we just get into payroll deductions. These are the kinds of things, that you're used to looking at when you're filling out the means test, retirement contributions, union dues, life insurance, health insurance. And then here at the bottom is where we start to get into the local standards. These are things for housing, transportation. With respect to these, you will get either the local standard or the debtor's actual expenses, whichever is lower. But in any event, even if your client's expenses are higher, you need to include the actual amount and then provide an explanation. We go to the next one. So this is, the sort of other necessary expense category, alimony, child support, things that are not coming out as payroll deduction, child care expenses, health insurance, delinquent tax obligations that are not being discharged, other student loans, for example, private student loans that they may have that they're not trying to discharge through the AP case. Can we move to the next slide? Some of these categories do require you to provide an explanation for why your expenses are higher and why those higher expenses are necessary. If you cannot provide a full explanation in just one or two sentences, then I suggest you maybe help your client provide a narrative that you can attach so that you can just say, see exhibit B. I make that suggestion because I found that the text boxes that are in the fillable PDF can be limited in some ways. That's just my personal preference. So take it for what it's worth. Also, I'm not suggesting that you should write a novel. You shouldn't, but where you may need maybe three or four paragraphs in order to provide a full explanation or provide some context or clarity, if it's me, I'm putting that in an attachment.
Just wanted to give a brief, I know Stephanie, you briefly mentioned the time. And so we have about 10 minutes left.
Okay, so let's go to the next slide. Here we're getting into the future inability to repay. There's that five-factor checklist. If you can answer yes to any one of these, it creates a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, that the inability to pay will persist throughout a significant portion of the repayment period. We can go to the next slide. Question 19. This is another five-factor checklist. Here, these do not create a rebuttable presumption. But, you know, in the example that we provided, you'll see, you know, that the debtor had a master's degree, but was only able to obtain, you know, part-time, low-wage jobs. That narrative also went through her whole, like, 10-year work history so that we could show, A, she had been trying to work, that she nevertheless had been unemployed for 5 of the last 10 years when, you know, effectively unemployed for 5 of 10 years, a gradual decline in the types of jobs she was able to perform, and that she was unable to maintain employment in the field that she was qualified for. If we can move. Oh, one other thing I wanted to say, is this where this part is? So can we go to the next slide? So here it asks you, you know, for other circumstances that make it so that they will be unable to make payments for, you know, this is where, you know, you really need to get into it with your client. And also for this area, if it's been a long time since your client has been out of school, their loans entered repayment, they're probably not going to have this information readily on hand. So you're going to want to make sure that you get that NSLDS file. Especially because, you know, here we get into the prior efforts to repay. So how many payments have you made, if any? What your payments should be? Have you applied for forbearances, deferments? All of this stuff is going to be in that student loan history that you can get either from the NSLDS website or that will be provided to you by the AUSA. If we can go to the next page. So at 26 here, so good faith. One of the things I wanted to point out to you was that here, you know, they also may include any efforts you made to apply for a federal loan, respond to outreach from, can we go to the next slide? Loan servicer, or engage meaningfully with a third party you believed would assist you in managing your student loan debt. So arguably, as debtor's counsel, that's you, both in, you know, filing the bankruptcy and in filing the AP case. Current assets, this goes through real estate, vehicles, and you go to the next one. Retirement accounts and interest in businesses. What I think is interesting here, tax refunds. What is interesting here is that the attestation does not appear to ask for information about deposit accounts, checking accounts, savings accounts, non-investment or non-retirement investment accounts. Get this information from your client anyway in case they come back and ask for it, because you don't want to be caught off guard and figure out after the fact that your client's sitting on a $40,000 CD that, you know, then is going to become an issue. So get that information. And then lastly, additional circumstances. So here you have an opportunity to advocate for your client. Any additional circumstances that you think that you can fairly and reasonably justify, definitely address it. However, this is not an opportunity for you to indulge a client's desire to sort of throw a pity party for themselves. So if it's something that's sort of making you want to roll your eyes, it's probably going to have that same effect on whoever is reviewing it. And that's not the kind of reaction that you want to elicit. So I think that's about it for the attestation. I was just going to make a few sort of parting comments. Cooperate with the AUSA if they, you know, ask for additional time, ask for additional documents, be as responsive and receptive as you can be without, you know, compromising your client's position. If the AUSA comes back and will not stipulate to a discharge, unless you are super, super confident about your chances at trial, you're probably going to want to try and dismiss that case. Because as we said earlier, you know, a bankruptcy case can be reopened at any time. So maybe they don't, you know, maybe their circumstances are such now that, you know, they're just not going to stipulate to it, but something might change. And, you know, you don't want to get a judgment of non-dischargeability because then you're stuck with that. So that's all I had to say. Do we have time for a couple of questions?
I think we might have time for one. Let's see what the response is. But someone in the audience asked, how important is it if Schedule J differs from IRS and local standard expenses?
How important is it? Well, I mean, with your Schedule J, you know, if your expenses are not in line with the standards, then you have the opportunity to explain that. So I think, you know, it's not a big deal, but if those other expenses are, you know, we have clients who come and, you know, want to put things like cigarettes as an expense or, you know, an allowance for their kids is, you know, just things that, you know, aren't really going to be considered necessary. You know, your Schedule J will allow you to include, you know, things that AUSA is not necessarily going to go for, I think, but you guys chime in if I'm wrong.
Yeah, go ahead, Brendan.
Yeah, I think with Schedule J, it's just important if it's a national standard and the Schedule J is less, use the national standard. If Schedule J is more, explain what it is. And with the local standards, you know, you're stuck with the lesser of actual or what the local standard provides. But again, you can provide an explanation. So the fact that some numbers on Schedule J differ from what's allowable under the guidance, that's not fatal in my mind. It depends on which one's lower, which one's higher. Is it a national? Is it a local standard? So I guess I'm saying it's perfectly fine for the numbers to be different. Just make sure that you compare and see if it's national, local, lower, or higher, and provide explanations.
I think we have time for one more question. And thank you, Stephanie. Thank you, Brendan, for that. A follow-up to Stephanie's question, do you have any tips on reading the AUSA or the NDSL report? And if for those who might not be aware of what those acronyms are, can you just break it down just simply so that we're all on the same page, please?
The National Student Loan Database is sort of the repository where your client can go and they can pull all their student loan history. There is a dashboard there where you can pull several types of reports. You know, one is enrollment history that will show like what schools they were enrolled in, whether they graduated, if they did, the dates. It's going to tell you when the loans went into repayment, all those sorts of things. What I would suggest is that you have your client print those reports, because if you try and download the file, what you're going to get is a text file that will be largely indecipherable to you, but that you'll be able to use if you're going to use, you know, third-party preparation where it allows you to upload a text file so that it can populate the form for you. But, you know, there is a lot of information on the NSLDS website, different reports that are going to provide you with just lots of information.
Did that answer it? And the AUSA, the information that we provide from Department of Education at the beginning is generally easier to understand and often includes some of the same information that you're getting from the NDSL report, but it is in the printable form that Stephanie mentioned, as opposed to this text file. So it should be easier to read and understand.
Great. So it looks like we are at, we're past three, and I want to thank everyone for joining us. Thank you, Raquel, Brendan, Stephanie. This was very informative, a great follow-up discussion to the previous discussion on student loan discharge, which occurred last year in 2023. So thank you to everyone who joined us and had questions. Please feel free to, follow up, look at the materials that have been provided to you. And we look forward to just continuing this discussion. And thank you so much.
Anybody who has a question that we didn't get to, feel free to email me. And if I can answer it for you, I will.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.